Blog Talk Radio.
I'm a truth terrorist. I'm a knowledge gangster. I'm a black history hitman. I'm a lie killer, urban gorilla. I gotta be a roughneck.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers. F up the black police. That 13th Amendment. Trying to make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
Show.
They got me started, lying hearted, I'm the new Mufasa. And I'm all about Umoja, first in Gruz Usaba. Let's bring back the black families, we need our father. Single mama, son and daughter, that's root of the problem. Wise up, we wise up, unity so powerful. Black banks, black schools, black owned, black power moves. You telling lies, you think this shit's gonna be televised. Black power, be scared guys, they be standing there like they paralyzed, huh? We say fuck the system, cause we above the system. We keep ARs and pistols, shotguns that's worth the crystal. But that's for self-defense, make sure we have no issues. Be sure to leave it at the door if you have it with you. This for them freedom fighters, that lost their freedom. Until they freedom, we screaming carpe diem. This for the general, King Khalid Muhammad. We gon' make your day a holiday, I fuck me promise.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. That 13th Amendment, tryna make a slave of me. You can lock my body, can't trap my mind, not forever be free.
Okay.
Free the Black Panthers, FCBP. Stand for free the Black Panthers, and fuck the black police. Feds infiltrated our movements for black leadership roles. But we still here, finna build here, up coin tail pro.
RBG, 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 RBG. My sisters, my brothers, the council, the elders, cause that's really all I need. We suited, we booted, don't do it, you stupid, we head to the armory. Black woman and goddess, regardless, my heart just don't fuck with misogyny. Bullshit, I don't tolerate it. Melanated, so you gotta hate it. Barack upped up another conversation. Trump finna get inaugurated, damn. Unify or die, NBPP.org.
First and foremost, the new Black Panther Party, no other Black Panther Party, we are not violent. We are for self-defense and self-determination. The most violent group in this country are the police. What is taking place by the police department to black people across this country is ethnic cleansing and genocide. It has escalated since the day that Barack Obama was inaugurated in 2008. We have a people who are only 13% of the population, yet we make up 80% of the prison. We have 50% unemployment rate in the black community, and it's actually even more than that because they're not counting our people that are in the prison. The 13th Amendment says you cannot be made a slave or indentured servant unless you commit a crime. The 14th Amendment forced our people to be subjects of this government. We never had any say in that. We need our own nation.
And may I say there equally that they have failed to take the decisions to include Africa, the African Union, as a fundamental core member of the G7, which would then become G8 again, or G20, which should, in fact, go even beyond Africa, but that is another lecture. This year's global political climate has been as hot, truly, as the world's temperatures. And as leaders, we must ensure that people have real access to the fundamentals of development, that lives of dignity can be theirs. That's how you build trust. That's how it's built. And where leaders and institutions must not, as Kofi put it, leave our citizens, and I quote, to rot on the margins of the world economy, to rot on the margins of the world economy. So trust and inclusions, how do we build them? What we need, my friends, is a new internationalism, a truly inclusive United Nations and international system. The United Nations was forged with the intention that it should be, and I quote, the indispensable common house of the entire human family. The indispensable common house of not half, not a quarter, not three quarters, of the entire human family. And for a while, it was getting there. But we have to ask ourselves in the last 77 years, haven't we recognized that the world has changed? And if the organization is to serve today's member states, if it is to not run the risk of becoming irrelevant, it has to be more inclusive. The United Nations, particularly the Security Council, must be reflective of the current geopolitical realities and indeed of the birth of new nations. There cannot continue to be a situation where the Security Council, in an organization of 195 member states, has five permanent members which have a right of veto and can use it to frustrate the will of the majority, as we saw in this year of our Lord. It cannot be an institution that purports to serve a modern world and which is prepared to deliver on a future for the next generation when it carries, that it carries, and when it is constrained by what? Simply the cloak of history, simply an imperialistic order that threatens to survive against the will of the majority of the people of this earth? My friends, I want to turn now to a second impact, an important expression of Kofi's thought and legacy, which is intimately connected to one of the greatest challenges countries like mine are facing today. A dozen years ago, in 2009, in the wake of the global financial crisis, Kofi Annan spoke passionately about the disproportionate impact of the crisis on developing countries. A dozen years ago, states which had done little or nothing to cause that financial crisis, but who once again were on the front lines and bearing the biggest damage. There were casualties. My country has not recovered from it, and that is a battle that I have been fighting during the stewardship of my time as Prime Minister. The parallels to the climate crisis are, of course, startling. Kofi Annan then recommended a slew of actions, and I want you to listen carefully to what he proposed. But we're not doing anything new. Immediate assistance. When somebody's bleeding, if you don't stop the bleeding, you could as well call the undertaker. Immediate assistance. Two, concessional lending and temporary financial support. Three, action to help countries tackle and adapt to the emerging climate crisis as it was then. Four, investment to strengthen, listen carefully, food systems. Five, a level playing field in global trade. Six, international financial institutions that reflect the makeup of the world and give opportunities to emerging economies and to least developed countries. He was candid, noting that the role of the international financial institutions has often been resented, that policy conditionality and fiscal prescriptions have been controversial, not least as their impact on growth and human development had been disputed. Today, the United Nations estimates that some 1.2 billion people in 94 countries are now at risk of food, energy, and financial stability. Over 71 million people have already been pushed into extreme poverty with hotspots in the Balkans, the Caspian Sea, and the Sahel regions. Rich countries have bailed out the banks. They've subsidized fossil fuel companies. They've stood by as food, as energy, and as pharmaceutical companies have seen their profits soar to egregious levels. And they have blocked progress on funding to help developing countries address the loss and damage that they have already suffered due to climate crisis. And may I say, with the exception of Denmark, who created precedent this week by committing $13 million to loss and damage, so that this is now a live and very present issue that cannot be allowed today. The countries, as I said earlier, failed to mobilize the $100 billion in SDR reallocation that we all asked for. They have blocked proposals that would have made the IMF and the World Bank more representative of the world in which we live. Thank you very much, Mark. And Messi, may I call you Nan? Please. The truth is that even before I start, the emotion is very heavy. And the emotion is heavy because I'm still a little girl that watched Kofi Annan and Nelson Mandela and Fidel Castro and Bill Clinton and all of these people who define the world in which I grew up, as much as I was inspired by Bob and Jimmy and Sparrow and others. So that this is a special moment because it allows us to truly pay tribute to a man ahead of his times. And as I said, this is truly a privilege to have been asked by this group of organizations to give this inaugural lecture in honor of this man ahead of his times, Kofi Annan. For many states, the multilateral system that Kofi championed for his professional life is of the highest importance. He knew that big places are made up of small places. And when he visited my own country, Barbados, in 2002, it was special for us. For he came to inaugurate a new United Nations house. And he expressed this with his usual sensitivity and candor. And I quote, "Small countries appreciate that collective interests and collective action is also the national interest. What happens in your nations is of great concern to the rest of the world. Your countries are places where, in concentrated form, many of the main problems of development and environment are unfolding. Your experiences, your experiments, your transformation can guide the way to a brighter future for all peoples." Those were his words. I therefore speak to you today in a mode of reflection and as a daughter of the African diaspora and the leader of one of those countries of which he spoke in that quotation. I speak to you about the life and legacy of one of Africa's finest sons, one who led the world truly and made that real difference. Kofi Atta Annan, Nobel laureate, orator, visionary, mediator, intellectual, optimist, and above all, a gentleman. I speak to you about how that legacy resonates so strongly today as the world is confronted with perils and challenges unknown for generations, but against which Kofi warned us time and time again. Today, a proud daughter, as I said, of Africa will speak to the legacy and vision of an African son, a legacy of which we can all be proud and a vision with which I and many others closely identify. Make no mistake, Kofi Annan's perspective and work were shaped by the fact that he was African, that he understood the enduring impacts of colonization on the environment, on society, on the economy, and on psyche, our psyche. His approach as Secretary General, I believe, was influenced by the fact that across his continent, the struggle for peace, to end poverty, the desire to have a desire for genuine independence and true self-governance still endured against a history of colonial occupation, citizen oppression, rampant resource exploitation, and regrettably, as I've said over and over, an imperialistic post-World War II order still very much in place. In these remarks, I would like to look at him as an African son, as a global citizen, and assess his contribution, his legacy, and his vision as Secretary General of the United Nations. I believe we have an obligation so to root him today. It was my honor and pleasure to meet him on that occasion when he visited Barbados exactly 20 years ago. I was then a young minister carrying the portfolio of Attorney General, having come out of Minister of Education, Youth and Culture. My hair tells me that time has flown, but my body and mind tell me that it was yesterday. Speaking at the opening, he paid tribute to our country's aspirations, capacities, and our achievements. And he made a statement that every Barbadian will tell you continues to be quoted by all, that Barbados punches far above its weight in the global community. It brought pride to our people when he delivered those remarks. It was a generous compliment, and believe you me, we continue to embrace it with enthusiasm and pride. And perhaps that is our continued inspiration coming from a rock of 166 square miles. We accept this kind of responsibility that comes with it, understanding only too well the battles that have been fought have been hard won, and that we must continue to fight new battles as we are all understanding today. Shortly after Barbados successfully hosted the first United Nations Conference on Small Island Developing States in 1994, marking the first time that the United Nations held a global conference in one of the world's smallest states, we knew that that was part of his legacy, or part of what he was saying, sorry, to describe us. Similarly, I speak to you today as president of UNCTAD, having been the smallest nation again to lead that conference in Barbados last year in October of 2021. I didn't know him well, and it is perhaps a great regret, as I said to Nan this morning, but I feel deeply the connection of his work to our work today that we have been entrusted to do. So forgive me, please, just as I've asked your permission, to formally refer to him in this lecture as Kofi. It is a sign of affection, respect, inspiration, and indeed, connection. When I use the words respect, inspiration, connection, I'm really referring to his ideas and his actions on the global stage, but also, as has been said this morning, to who he was as a man. His country of birth, Ghana, equally has a special place in our hearts, and indeed the genes of Barbadians. Barbados was an Akan-speaking nation before the end of the 17th century. Many of our ancestors came from that region. And yes, through a crime against humanity, but on that gross and tragic history, we truly have forged new bonds. In 2019, the president of Ghana visited Barbados and became the first head of state other than Queen Elizabeth II to address a joint sitting of the Barbados Parliament. And I equally had the honor to speak before the Ghanaian Parliament. And in March of this year, I had the distinct honor to speak at the 65th anniversary of the independence celebrations of the people and government of Ghana, so that the connections are more emotional, as I said. We opened our first diplomatic mission in Africa, in Accra, last year. And just a few weeks ago, literally, we co-hosted with the African Export-Import Bank, the first ever Africa-Caribbean Trade and Investment Forum, under the theme of One People, One Destiny, Uniting and Reimagining Our Future. And simply put, to be able to remove the middleman, the middle leg, and finally, the scars of the middle passage. This is a small measure of the broader picture and relations that bind our region in the Caribbean to the great continent of Africa together. And today, we are offering the connections for all, both from the heart, but also the head. And I say so conscious that there are three United Nations headquarters. And for the majority of the independence of Caribbean nations' lives, we've had representatives in two of the three, but not in the third in Africa. We chose to correct that last year as well by opening our mission in Nairobi, Kenya, ensuring that we remove those bridges that, in the words of Marcus Messiah Garvey, need to be removed as we emancipate ourselves from mental slavery. As Secretary General, Kofi Annan's achievements are stellar. I'll mention a few before I want to look into a few aspects of his thought this morning. The International Criminal Court came into being during Kofi's first term as Secretary General in 1998. For us, it is even more special, for it was the idea of the Prime Minister, then of Trinidad and Tobago, A&R Robinson. It is a court with significant Caribbean connection, as I said, and Kofi Annan brought his powers of persuasion to bear on the subject, and by so doing, was able to achieve the establishment of the court, which had been opposed by influential countries. Indeed, if I may, when the United States government, and this is for perspective, decided that they wanted to have a waiver from prosecution, immunity from prosecution with Article 98, they threatened that they would remove all military support from those countries that would not support them. The Caribbean countries remained resolute and indicated, and I was then Deputy Prime Minister, so I remember it clearly, that we would hate that you should do such a thing. But if that is your will, let it be done. And it was after that, for the first time, that China offered military aid to the Caribbean. Kofi Annan's work in strong collaboration, Mark, with you on the Millennium Development Goals in 2000 were truly inspirational and groundbreaking. It created a common development agenda for the entire multilateral system in the world. And the MDGs today, of course, have led to the SDGs and Agenda 2030. And I stand to you as a co-chair of the advocates group of the SDGs, and proudly so. For I have said, the Millennium Development Goals and the SDGs are simply our development work to make the world better and to allow people to sleep easier each and every night. And there can be no more noble mission. Even as we set these missions together, we struggle as an international community today to attain these goals. No one, in spite of the difficulty of us finding financing for them, no one can dispute the value, the impact, and the universality of these goals. They remain as undiminished today as when you and Kofi settled them so many years ago. He launched the Global Compact in 2000, the objective being to encourage greater corporate social responsibility. And we have seen that at both the national and international levels, and to advocate for greater collaboration between the private sector and the United Nations. And we have equally seen that continue. Under Kofi Annan's watch, we saw the establishment in 2002 of the groundbreaking Global Fund to Fight Tuberculosis, AIDS, and Malaria. And you will forgive me if I pause here yet again, for one of the chairmen of that body was a person who I call my big sister, Dr. Carol Jacobs, who led it with distinction. And her assistant is, in fact, now my permanent secretary, Alice Jordan, if I'll ask her to stand, so that she, too, can be recognized as part of that journey. I today benefit from the experience which she earned by being part of that journey with respect to the management and leadership of the Global Fund. And, of course, Kofi was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize in 2001, along with the United Nations. The Nobel Committee's citation paints the critical arch under which he worked. And I quote, "While clearly underlining the UN's traditional responsibility for peace and security, he has also emphasized its obligations with regard to human rights. He has risen to such new challenges as HIV and AIDS and international terrorism, and brought about more efficient utilization of the UN's modest resources. In an organization that can hardly become more than its members permit, he has made clear that sovereignty cannot be a shield behind which member states conceal their violations." End quote. I want today to draw on two primary sources of Kofi's thinking. December 11, 2006, he gave his final speech as UN Secretary General. He chose the Truman Presidential Museum and Library in Harry Truman's home state of Missouri as a homage to an American president whom he described as the master builder and the faithful champion of the organization in its early years, unquote. In the cold Missouri winter, not so far from where he started his journey as a young student on scholarship in Minnesota half a century earlier, he shared what he described as the five lessons from him in his time in office. And I share them with you now. The first lesson was about the value and importance of collective responsibility. We don't live alone. And we cannot survive alone. In the collectives are equity, protection, and strength. The challenges we face are global, and they demand a global response. They demand global leadership, strategic, moral leadership. Yet as members of the human family and leaders of the countries of the world, we are confronted with the greatest threats to development and human well-being. We are confronted with a clear and present danger of the existential threat posed by the climate crisis to all in the future, but today to all living between the tropics of Cancer and Capricorn. If I was given this speech in the spring of this year, I might have had to work a little harder to persuade those who are deniers. But the last summer says it all. And as we would say as lawyers, res ipsa loquitur, the facts speak for themselves. We are confronted, therefore, with the unstoppable and destructive power, equally, I should say, of that of a pandemic on top of a climate crisis, and the looming danger, not just of the pandemic of which you are aware, COVID-19. But the one that I worked with the World Health Organization as chair, co-chair with the Prime Minister of Bangladesh in the One Health Global Initiative to try and bring attention to the slow motion, silent pandemic of antimicrobial resistance, making the possibility that we can reverse a century of medical progress a reality if we don't confront it. Today, we're equally facing the fragility of global supply chains. And only before coming into this room, I shared with you our own experience in Barbados as a result of Hurricane Fiona threatening access to natural gas to those of us in the region, because that is a source from which we purchase our natural gas in addition to what we use and develop from our onshore resources. But have we really understood Kofi's lesson that without collective responsibility, our chances of defeating these monsters are truly jeopardized? A spring and summer from the USA to China, as I just said. I mean, just look at it. Look at it. Floods and wildfires. I can't imagine what it is like to live in California and to have the risk that everything you own, most importantly from the pictures of your grandmother and your grandfather to the mementos given, lost because of fire. Freak storms has happened in my own country last year when in 90 minutes we had 46,000 lightning strikes. It was like having a strobe light remain constant. And if I didn't experience it, I would challenge the person and say that it was an act of fiction to which they were referring. Heat so scorching that the airport at Heathrow had to be closed when the runway started to melt. And of course now, the apocalyptic floods of Pakistan affecting 33 million people and leaving 1,500 people dead. How many more, in the words of one of my own friends and cabinet, former cabinet members, John King, in his wonderful song, how many more must suffer? How many more? How many more economies must be pushed to the brink? I ask us to think of these things. The second matter, of course, and the lesson that he gave us on that speech was the necessity for global solidarity. If ever there was a time for global solidarity, that time was presented to us in the last 2.5 years with the COVID-19 pandemic. The virus spread all over the world, touching every shore, killing millions and causing untold harm to millions more, disrupting our lives and everything we came to cherish about it. I remind you that Kofi had cautioned us in an almost prescient foretelling. And forgive me once again for quoting him, because you must understand why I say he was a man ahead of his time. And I quote, all of us are vulnerable to what we think of as dangers that threaten only other people. But millions of Americans could quickly become infected if a new disease were to break out in a country with poor health care and be carried across the world by unwitting air travelers before it was identified. Has it sunk in? While the COVAX facility was supposed to ensure vaccine doses to the larger populations of developing countries through vaccine nationalism and outright shameless hoarding, by November 2021, some 576 million doses had gone to developing countries, while developed countries held how many? 7.5 billion doses. Where's the justice in that? Where is it? Where is the global solidarity? To the end, Kofi Annan believed in his third lesson. And what is that? Something that we cherish greatly in my own nation. The rule of law, the platform for both undergirding and delivering peace and development. Yeah. For without the rule of law, there is no platform for either. He was a mediator on difficult global issues and believes in respect for sovereignty and the rule of law at the national and domestic levels as a precursor, as I said, for peace and prosperity. It is ironic that yesterday, the theme of my speech to the General Assembly was peace, love, and prosperity. And I therefore spoke in the shadow of Kofi Annan yesterday as I called for that in the global community. He would have been, he would truly have been in his element today. As we consider history in the Karonga world, it is true to say that the UN has lived up to its mandate of preventing the scourge of another world war. But we have not eliminated small wars, saber rattling, or sectarian violence. A survey of the global security situation, notably in Eastern Europe and in the Middle East, but in many other places as well, like in Africa, it reminds us daily of the tragic inability of the international system to deliver more peace and more security to the many vulnerable people of the world. We simply must work harder. For I ask, when will we as a global community prefer the silence or music of peace over the dissonant songs and prophets of war? And regrettably, I fear that those who favor profiteering are winning the battle over those of us who want the silence of peace. And then, of course, there was mutual accountability, which was Kofi's fourth lesson. For me, this raises the question, as we would say in that famous calypso in the Caribbean, who can guard the guard? Who will guard the guards? The European Union and the OECD have developed black and gray lists of other countries that they deem non-compliant with rules which govern anti-money laundering measures and counter-terrorism financing measures. They frame the rules. They act as judge and jury. They treat their countries preferentially as they pronounce verdicts, often without the application of the rules of natural justice, which gave an accused a right to be heard and to prove their innocence. And countries for years, like ours, have been put on blacklists. I want to salute for the first time, however, the leadership of President von der Leyen and Frans Timmermans, who I think are beginning to appreciate the message that we are bringing. But the complexity of the architecture that makes these lists still remains the obstacle. For they will tell you, as I shall share with you, that while the Commission may have a perspective, fundamentally it is the actions of member states acting in their own political sovereignty that constitute ECOFIN. But can we continue to carry the burden of architectures that are inconvenient truths and behind which many will hide? I say no. It's not our banks that precipitated the global financial scandal and crisis 15 years ago. It's not through our banks that the majority of the corrupt proceeds pass. The countries which bear the responsibility for the real problems in global financial services appear to be exempt from the rules and the scrutiny to which developing countries are subjected. And let me yet again go back to Kofi's words. Accountability of states to their citizens, of states to one another, of international institutions to their members, and of this present generation to future ones is essential for our success. I ask you, who then is going after the real centers of money laundering and the safe havens for corrupt capital? What does mutual accountability look like? And how do we put it in place? And I say simply, where have they found the money from the Russian oligarchs? It hasn't been on the sunny shores of the Caribbean. Yet again, res ipsa loquitur, the facts speak for themselves. The necessity and value of multilateralism was his fifth lesson. And Kofi shared that as he spoke in Missouri, and I quote yet again, "It is only through multilateral institutions that states can hold each other to account. And that makes it very important to organize these institutions in a fair and democratic way giving the poor and the weak some influence over the actions of the rich and the strong. My friends, when put this way, questions follow naturally. Questions of effectiveness, questions of what is now commonly called fitness for purpose of international organizations, questions about the future of multilateralism in a world with an extreme tendency to populism, a rising tide of nationalism, religious sectarianism, and a world that has changed since the institutions of the past, which were supposed to save the world and its people, was established. Does multilateralism, as we know it today, effectively address our common problems of security, inequity and inequality, exclusion, the climate crisis, socioeconomic deprivation? Do they exist to find solutions for our common future and deliver the world as we want? Does it give credence or impetus to our common agenda, as our current Secretary General urges us, and I feel for him and his courageous leadership. I feel for him, for he continues to be that voice imploring us to take on the common agenda. Does multilateralism today, as it is being practiced, enlarge our freedoms? Freedom from want, freedom from fear, freedom to live in dignity. It is my view that we cannot and will not deliver on the large or small freedoms, on the absence of want, fear, or indeed to create a pervasive culture of dignity until we deal with the fundamental issue of citizen inclusion and active citizenship. My own charter in Barbados, as we became a republic last year, speaks specifically to the role of active citizenship. I do not intend to detain you today with a treatise on it, but suffice it to say that the other person who inspired me in my work, the late, great Nelson Mandela, I have the honor to do a lecture in his name in November, and it is to that that I will be speaking on that occasion. One of the greatest challenges facing leaders today is the deficit of trust. Distrust creates distance between citizens on the one hand and leaders and institutions on the other. Those institutions could be national, they could be regional, they could be global. Distrust forever fosters the same consequences. Where there is distrust, there is also alienation and exclusion. We know it. We've lived it. We've seen it. And trust has currency, on the other hand. It has value. It is a fulcrum for social stability. Trust, we know, is built when citizens become invested in their own society, the one in which they live. And that investment comes from citizens feeling a sense of social and economic inclusion, feeling that they have something on the line, something to gain and something to lose, believing that they're valued, that they're seen, that they're heard, and that they're felt, simply put, as I keep saying, and that ultimately they have a future. Trust comes when citizens believe and can attest to the existence, yes, of global, moral, strategic leadership, which acts as an ethical compass for economic equity and social equality for its citizens. Trust, my friends, and inclusion are indivisible. But it doesn't occur by accident. It's not the random byproduct of chaotic governance or poor governance structures, or weak and failing institutions, or leadership that is alienated from the populace. Deep and increasing distrust results when citizens believe that their governments, national and global institutions, are disconnected from them, do not represent their views, and are not concerned about including them. They don't see them, they don't feel them, they don't hear them. Inclusion, on the other hand, involves giving individuals agency, the power of agency, the dignity of agency, a say in their own affairs, and a stake above all else in their own society and economy in which they live. And you know, when citizens in the developed world believe that they have no obligation to help developing nations, it is because they do not know and may not wish to know that it was the slave trade and it was the guns that built empires, and empires that financed industrialization, and that the face of colonization allowed their countries to thrive and to become wealthy, that my country and others like mine are pushed to the brink of disaster as a result of it. And the very same countries which have pushed us there while growing their economies will take the money made at the expense of our blood, our sweat, and our tears and lend it to us at commercial rates or insurance premium to fix the climate crisis that they have caused by extracting the money from us to fuel the Industrial Revolution, which fuels now the climate crisis. I call it double jeopardy. It is wrong, it is unfair, it is unjust, and fundamentally, it supports everything that we are being told for the last two decades that should not happen. They tell us that the polluter shall pay, but in truth, it is their profits that benefit instead of paying. We cannot abide this injustice any longer. And when we make the case for reparations, it is not a case that is being made with emotion or acrimony, but it is simply to right size the wrongs so that we can go together in harmony as one to fight the great battles of our time. But as Earl Lovelace, that great Trinidadian author, said in the book that for me is the work of his life, that took him more than 10 years to write, and that won the Commonwealth Book Prize, the book called Salt. Yes. Without the conversation and without the resolution, there can be no progress, because forever there shall be a burning and settled agenda in the chest of so many that therefore dissipates the energy that we need to come together to fight the greatest battles of humanity. My friends, trust is also not created when countries pledge, as I said yesterday, $100 billion per annum for climate finance and then deliver a fraction to developing countries. Or when the same countries commit to 0.7% of GDP as of ODA, development assistance, but we don't see it nor get it. Or when the countries that stop others from exploiting newfound fossil fuels are historically the world's largest producers and polluters. And I just gave you the story of our experience with the Clean Energy Bridge of Natural Gas that the International Energy Agency says must still be part of the equation in 2050, because you will still need 20% fossil fuels. And as I said yesterday and over this week, there is a disconnect between commitments and capacity. And unless we have the granular planning and organization, we may find ourselves romanticizing, as we should all love to do, but not being able to make the brand real because we can't deliver on it. My country this year committed to a tax holiday for electric vehicles. 2-year tax holiday. One problem, the supply is so limited that only a few can benefit from it. My country, this year, we determined that we could not leave the sun, the wind, and the ocean to be privatized for the benefit of a few, and that therefore every Barbadian household where the person owns the house shall have, as of right, the right to have renewable energy on their roofs, so that they too can benefit from the bounty that this green revolution effectively provides, such that not only large local capital or foreign capital should benefit from it. My friends, we do that, but then we hear that there's a difficulty in accessing the batteries that are necessary to make it a reality, and that lithium is in short supply. So that unless we match capacity and commitment, we will end up with people not falling through the safety net, but falling through chasms that we have left open. Trust equally does not follow when the world's citizens can see, and once again I use Kofi's language, that the Global Partnership for Development is more than a phrase, is now more phrase than fact. We can't be paying lip service to it and expect people to trust us. And may I say there equally that they have failed to take the decisions to include Africa, the African Union, as a fundamental core member of the G7, which would then become G8 again, or G20, which should in fact go even beyond Africa, but that is another lecture. By the end of 2020, the global response to the COVID-19 pandemic was estimated to be around $20 trillion. 90% of that was spent by a small number, a handful of rich countries. Just 0.04% of that was pledged to SIDS, Small Island Developing States, LDCs, and LLDCs, countries most in need by actual proof. And now, my friends, regrettably, we continue to be on track to make the same mistakes yet again. To some, this may sound like the appeal of a Global South leader for funding in times of crisis. I can assure you it is not. This is about getting the world on track. This is about learning from our mistakes. This is about finding just solutions to current threats and longstanding inequalities that the world can no longer bear, that people can no longer abide. It is fundamentally about our interconnected fates and the reality check that developed economies cannot escape the spread of the climate crisis, or indeed the financial woes or debt crisis, if we do not cater for all. You know, as children we learned, the Three Musketeers, all for one and one for all. Is that only a fable for children to enjoy a level of romanticism only to be immediately disappointed as they become adults? If a call to solidarity and justice, or what I like to say in simple language, Mark, togetherness and fairness, because sometimes this language gets too highfalutin. So let's break it down. Fairness, that every child knows, and togetherness, because nobody small can't achieve anything without cooperation from somebody else. Togetherness. If fairness and togetherness will not spark the response we need to the convergent crises stalking the world, we will end up with a response that's purely based on self-interest. And the world will look like the wild, wild, wild west, as it did so many times during COVID, and continues to do even today, as I said, with access to scarce resources, with the global supply chain being disrupted. Earlier this year, we started an exercise, yes, of talking and discussing with civil society, with academics, with some countries, drawing on our experience and theirs, and putting together a small list of policy priorities. strategic and focused that have, in our view, the rarity of being both achievable and meaningful. We call it the Bridgetown Agenda because we ask people to come and join us there and to reflect on these things so that we could see how we could make the world a better place. Not because Barbados has that power. We don't. We're 166 square miles. But it is because we have that conscience and we feel the need to speak, even if others will call it a cry of conscience. And even if others will ask, who are they? We are simply ordinary people trying to make the world a better place and trying to appeal to those who actually have the power so to do. Today, we remind them and we remind ourselves that it is unprecedented because we have a trifecta of connected crises. The cost of living crisis stemming, of course, partly from the Russian invasion of Ukraine and the pandemic together, coming as they did overlapping. A developing country debt crisis following the pandemic and climate-related disasters that we're seeing. And may I remind you that tourism and travel-dependent economies such as mine came out of the first year of the pandemic with double-digit economic declines because the tourists simply could not come because of the shutdown. And finally, the climate crisis as the glaciers melt and the storms and the droughts intensify. And we call the storms and hurricanes the heart attacks of the climate crisis. And we call the droughts and the sargassum weed the chronic NCDs of the climate crisis. And both are fatal. This situation is compounded by tightening monetary policies in developed countries, and a strengthening of the US dollar. One in five countries today is experiencing fiscal and financial stress. One in five countries. Unaddressed, there will be deepening hardship. And we've already heard Kristalina talk about the difficult year that we are likely to face next year, more so than this year. The deepening hardship is there. The debt defaults are imminent. The widening inequality continues unabated. And the political upheaval comes as a consequence of that widening inequality. And of course, there is the threat of the delayed shift to low carbon. Global leaders are, I would like to believe, now experienced in managing crises. The last few years have made them that. They know what to do, and they have the means necessary. We must act now, not next year or the year after, or when the next set of leaders come. We cannot be good at rescuing banks, but not good at saving countries. We cannot be good at rescuing banks, but not good at saving countries. And I speak now on behalf of all the countries that are at risk, not just on behalf of my own. Not because they have asked me to do so, but because it is the right and moral thing to do. The first step, therefore, we suggest immediately, is to provide liquidity to stop the debt crisis in its track. I said earlier, if you're bleeding, each of us knows the first thing to do is stop the bleeding. And just because you did it early in the pandemic does not mean that you don't do it again. Because the reality is that we don't face a mono crisis. I just spoke about the trifecta. And take care, it becomes a superfecta. We therefore call upon the board more so than the management, the political directorates who constitute the board of the International Monetary Fund at the annual meetings in 2 weeks' time in October. To do one, return access to its unconditional rapid credit and financing facilities to the previous crisis levels. I just told you that we are not facing a mono crisis. Two, temporarily suspend its interest surcharges for heavy borrowers because interest rates have already risen and there can be no justifiable reason for the maintenance of those temporary surcharges. Three, rechannel at least $100 billion of unused special drawing rights for those who need it. And also remember that almost on each occasion we leave unused SDRs on the table. Four, and I want to salute Kristalina for her courage in establishing the Resilience and Sustainability Trust, because it is the only long-term money to middle-income, climate-vulnerable countries that still have poor people. So don't ever forget that 70% of the world's poor actually live in middle-income countries, not low-income countries. And that RST, therefore, is designed to provide concessionary funds for climate-vulnerable countries to strengthen their climate resilience. We ask the IMF to operationalize that as a matter of urgency, as I know they're trying to do. And at the same time that we ask these things, the G20 countries should agree on a far more ambitious debt service suspension initiative that includes all multilateral development bank loans to the poorest countries and to some middle-income countries who are affected as a result of the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm not an economist, but from day one I said we need long-term capital to fight this crisis. And I don't want to delay you any further, but I remind you simply of what the United Kingdom was allowed to do for themselves in turning bonds of 1914 and 1917 in 1932 into perpetual bonds at a 5% interest rate instead of 3.5%, but allowed to pay it off when, Mark, in 2014, or when the developed world that won the war allowed Germany to be able to have its debt service capped at 5% of its exports revenue. Isn't this triple crisis not the equivalent of a World War I and World War II to the developing world? But my friends, liquidity alone is not enough. And these crises have systemic roots. And that is why we must address not just the outer symptoms, but the systemic roots. And therefore, only investment will change their course. So while addressing these immediate needs, we must also lay the path towards a new financial system that drives financial resources towards climate-related and sustainable development goals. The IMF must now have at its core not simply financial systemic crises, but integrate climate crises and other exogenous shocks as critical matters to which they must address their attention. These goals require the rapid scaling up of investment in low carbon transition in the energy, transport, and agricultural sectors to safeguard, I'm almost frightened to say it, a 1.5 degree Celsius target, providing for substantial investment in building climate resilience and sustainability, and critical investments, of course, and we shall never forget, in public health, education, and may I add to the list, the new currency of today's digital world, electricity and broadband. One, therefore, we call on the Multilateral Development Bank shareholders to implement the recommendations of the G20 capital adequacy framework and to do so by the end of this year. Two, that the World Bank and the other multilateral development banks must use the remaining headroom, must increase their risk appetite, and also look at new guarantees in the holding of special drawing rights to expand lending to governments at least by $1 trillion and to ensure that the tenor of that lending is appropriate to the needs of the moment, as I reflected just now. Three, that there should be new concessional London that prioritizes the attainment, yes, of the sustainable development goals everywhere and the building of climate resilience everywhere, but especially in climate vulnerable countries. Today's donors generally agree to offer concessional funding when a disaster has struck. And Mark, I said it at the goalkeepers this week, when they do so, it is too late, because all you're leaving me to do is to pay the undertaker, not to save lives. We need the money before the disaster, because their own efforts show that money spent, for every dollar spent before the disaster in resilience building, will save 7 times the investment in avoided loss and damage, not to mention loss of life. And finally, the task of transformation is too big for governments alone. Moreover, on a global public goods like the climate, we have to move beyond country by country responses that have become bogged down by issues of who should do more and who shouldn't. We need to ensure that we bring together those companies that are benefiting either egregiously from the provision of global public goods or that their behavior has caused the global public risk in the first place. And Zane, I take your additional point this morning and will ask to add it in our rhetoric and our communication, sorry, of sovereign wealth funds. Fourth, we need a global mechanism for raising reconstruction grants for any country that has been imperiled by a climate disaster. This is fundamentally the loss and damage argument, the framework that should be financed, we believe, by the fossil fuel industry and indeed the renewable energy industry that may benefit also from the provision of the solution. And we feel that this is what is consistent with our own motto in Barbados. As we manage crises, we share the burden, but we share the bounty. Five, we need a new issuance of $650 billion of special drawing rights or other low-interest long-term instruments to back the multilateral agencies, to create a new global balance sheet, if you like, that accelerates private investment in low-carbon transition wherever in the world it is most effective so to do. We have one climate. And why do we need that global balance sheet? Because most of our countries are already highly indebted countries, and therefore, even if you give me the money, if I don't have the fiscal space, I look at it and cannot touch it. Six, and I'm finishing soon, we need a change in the IMF articles so that it can direct future issues of special drawing rights to those who need it most. I understand that this will require U.S. congressional approval, because in truth and in fact, the U.S. has the ability to block it because they have 17% of the voting rights. And I'm told what is needed to change the Articles of Agreement is 85%. So let us get Congress on board, not just to focus on the 300 million people here, but the 7.5 billion people of the world. And seventh, and we call it now on all major issues, issuers of debt, of sovereigns and agencies to the markets that must help normalize and prioritize natural disaster and pandemic clauses. You know, there's nothing like an idea whose time has come. Barbados is the largest issuer of bonds with natural disaster clauses. And last night, a story appeared in the Financial Times indicating that the UNDP was in discussions with Pakistan to urgently and immediately enter discussions for debt relief so that they may be able to focus on the reconstruction of Pakistan. The genius of those debt clauses is that it keeps the lender whole, but it gives the borrower the fiscal space to meet the unenviable target of rebuilding. I maintain there is no country in the world, no institution in the world, no company, no individual in the world that will give Barbados the equivalent of 18% of GDP should a hurricane strike. That is what the natural disaster clauses do. And indeed, this week, when we issued blue bonds for the first time, repurchasing 150 million of our own euro bond with the backing of the Inter-American Development Bank and Nature Conservancy to create a marine conservation trust with savings and interest of over $50 million in the next 15 years, we took the opportunity to include, and it was agreed to, a pandemic clause that will do the same thing that the natural disaster clause did. If those pandemic clauses were in, we would not be talking about a DSSI of $12 billion, but we would have unlocked $1 trillion in liquidity for the developing world and for the developed and middle-income world. These clauses, as I say, are orderly, they're predictable, and they allow for a temporary debt standstill. And it would provide, as I said, that level of liquidity that is critical that no other instrument will. My friends, as I said, that paper I read in Pakistan, I'd like to, on Pakistan, please go and get it. They don't have those clauses yet, but what the UNDP is asking them to do is the equivalent of what those clauses would prescribe in a very clear way. So, if all debt instruments can have those clauses, we would immediately stop a lot of the bleeding and preempt what could otherwise be a serious liquidity crisis in the world. It just requires courage. It doesn't require a sword, but it requires the power of the pen. I've asked my staff today to distribute copies of the Bridgetown Agenda as we seek to build a global movement and coalition so that we can have a certain call and ask to the world to come together as one. You know, in the words of that famous song, "We Are the World," that I quoted yesterday, I go back to it. It is our time to lend a hand to life, for we are the world, and we are the children, and we are the ones who can truly make that brighter day. And yes, my friends, the challenges that we face in every country across the world are in many ways, yes, more severe than any that we have met, certainly in my lifetime. Wars, the pandemic, the climate, the energy crisis, the food security crisis, all wreaking untold havoc on the populations. And when I say it, sometimes I get queasy because we talk about populations, but that word doesn't capture the tragedy to each human being. Doesn't. And that crisis is happening not just in poor countries or middle-income countries. It is happening, as we are seeing, in rich countries where poor people are being left on the margins of even rich countries' development. This is a moral crisis. And our existing international fora must seek to navigate and drive global policy making and stop falling short in the moment of greatest need of our planet. The most lessons that we can learn in truth and in fact come from the life and work of Kofi Annan. And I don't say so arbitrarily, but I trust that as a good lawyer and advocate, I have laid the case today for you, and that the words speak clearly today to us, here and now. Res ipsa loquitur. The facts speak for themselves. We know what we must do as a global community. From the embers of the COVID and climate crisis, from the inadequacies and failings of the existing international system, from the desire of the global family for inclusion, from the need for capital investment, healthcare systems, and technological access, which will put people at the center of development, we are now challenged to look at what we have so far built, to consider now, and to craft what must now be. And it falls therefore to us to do that which has not yet happened, the social and economic inclusion of the world's people and the protection of the planet on which people live. The responsibility is ours to write by word indeed the new charter for the 21st century. And Kofi Annan made his farewell statement before the General Assembly in September 2006. He had 4.5 decades of experience serving this great body, the United Nations, and, of course, the international community. From a junior professional officer to the very apex of the organization, with the depth, breadth, through difficult times like this, Mike. Faced with the challenge of forging unity where there was division and creating order where there was chaos, it was with his customary clarity, candor, optimism, and above all else, dignity, that he concluded with this statement thus: "Yes, I remain convinced that the only answer to this divided world must be a truly United Nations. Climate change, HIV/AIDS, fair trade, migration, human rights, all these issues and many more bring us back to that point." That was his farewell message to the global community. Addressing each that is dispensable for us, each of us, he continued, in our village, in our neighborhood, and in our country. Yet each has acquired a global dimension that can be reached by global action, agreed and coordinated through this most universal of institutions. That was his farewell message. Yes, my friends, today there is a choice we're making. We are saving our own lives. It's true, we will make a better day. Just you and me, and you and you and you and you. Thank you.
That is read about, but about things that he is doing something about. Once again, as entrepreneurs, permit me to associate myself with the submissions of Mr. Moyo. I've had the advantage of listening to Madam Mabel, and this is a practitioner who has demonstrated that it can be done and that it must be done. And very lastly, before I came to the podium, I've had the advantage of listening to Dr. Pippin, who has passionately talked about the state and plight of Africa. And let me tell you that I am energized in a manner that will make my submission be very brief, because there is nothing new that I will say. When I listened to Dr. Pippin, it reminded me of a conversation that I had about Africa only last week. And as I was in the process of highlighting the problems that he has so highlighted and articulated, the audience was African, and during the question and answer session, somebody said, "But there is so much negativity about Africa." And I said, "How do you expect me to sing a wedding song at a funeral?" And I'm saying that what he has articulated is the state of Africa. The African problem has been analyzed. We know where the problems are. Our problem is that we are not daring to solve the problem. During the entire presentation, it has been assumed that we know who an entrepreneur is. And perhaps we know. But who is an entrepreneur? In simple terms, is he not a man or a woman acting individually or collectively, who, out of the desire to satisfy self, discovers or invents or creates a thing or an institution that benefits him or her, or the society, and improves the quality of life of society, and in a sustainable person? Is that not the individual that we call an entrepreneur? And that they are found in different sectors. And that this evening or this early evening we are here to ask ourselves as Africans how we can be entrepreneurs. How we can run institutions which are sustainable, which can improve the quality of our lives. Dr. Pippin has narrated to you his experience at the University of Cape Coast. How his breakfast table was crowded by products from other civilizations. Other entrepreneurs were benefiting from that. He has told you about the state of our continent, even in this very edifice. Our entrepreneurship is not evident. It is other civilizations. If you took a minute now to talk about our enterprise, the men and women in this assembly, I want you for 2 minutes to look at what you are wearing. And I can conclude that none of it comes from Zambia. And if there is not more than 10%, we are failing in the arena of entrepreneurship. Today, if you look at organizations that are run by Africans, because we are in an African setting, very few of them survive from one generation to the other. When we are called upon to teach about entrepreneurship in our universities, the models that we so proudly talk about are from Harvard, Cambridge, not our universities. And I want to submit to us that if Africa is to have serious entrepreneurship, we've got to change our mind. Our mind change has been talked about before I came to the podium. We must think differently. Today, if you care to ask, who controls the Zambian economy? They are not Zambians. And if they are Zambians, they are Zambians who are fair weather citizens. Who, when the chips are down, they run away from Zambia. Fact. Painful fact. If you go to Malawi, it's the same. You go to Kenya, it's the same. Tanzania is the same, Uganda is the same, Ghana is the same. What is this entrepreneurship that we are talking about that we want to teach our young men and women? Because let me tell you, if we don't change, we now talk very frequently about neocolonialism, the new colonialism. It is not going to be about a minister who is from the United Kingdom. The ministers will be your own. The presidents will be your own. The only thing that we are good at working at, our biggest enterprise in Africa today, is politics and political office. That is the biggest enterprise in all of Africa. We fight, kill and maim for it. Outside of that, we don't do very well. If you look at other civilizations, they have businesses that are passed from father to son, from father to son, from mother to daughter. But the only thing that we pass over to our son, there is political office in Africa, from father to son, from father to son. We cannot grow in that way. I remember Mr. Kanyama said he had indicated that I should talk about corporate governance. But should I? Should I? What is this corporate governance that we keep on talking about? Dr. Pippin said we should think outside of the box. I agreed with everything that he said except that one. Whose box? Whose box must we think about outside of? Why should the box be our point of reference? Who made that box? I'm saying we should think without any box. Moyo was giving good examples about Airbnb. Good. About Uber. Good. About Bolt. Good. About Gardewell. Good. About Knight and Frank. Good. But I would have loved if you would have given the example of Econet Straight Cyprus. He did not. He just mentioned that he worked there. That is an African. I would have loved for him to do that. And when they were projecting their images, allow me to be uncharitable to you, my brother. When they were projecting their images, my good friend Sanyama during the Q&A, there was a white woman and a white man. And that is dangerous. It creates the impression that it's only white people who can do it. We must stop that. We must now begin to make ourselves believe that we can do it. And let me tell you, images are important. Because those images have a lasting impact in our minds. And there is no shortage of Africans who are now beginning to do well. The men and women here are doing well. They are brand institutions. The next time I come, I want to see their images here. I want to see the image of Calvin Kaunda here. He has created a university out of nothing. And if you talk about corporate governance, he has a corporate governance structure that draws expertise from good men and women both within and without the Republic of Zambia. That is what we want. So today we are not going to say many things. No. It has all been said. We are simply asking you the master question. What are you going to do with the knowledge that you have acquired over the years? Today, Africa says under Africa Agenda 2063 that we want to be a middle-level economy. Are we working towards it? Do you who are present here know about Africa Agenda 2063 and its 7 pillars? Do you? And if you don't know, then how is Africa going to make it happen? How are we going to grow in our ignorance? We talk about sustainable development goals, 17 of them. Do we know what they are? And what we must do about them. And if you who are present here do not know about them, what enterprises are we going to create to address them? We are talking about Africa Continental Free Trade Area removal of type and untype barriers, freedom of movement of people and enterprise. Meanwhile, a few misguided South Africans are telling us to leave South Africa. Is that how enterprise is going to grow? These are the painful questions that we must ask. Because if we don't ask them, let me tell you, we are not making very useful value, giving useful value to our time. And Africa is in the business of celebrating very useless things. Our levels of satisfaction are very low. We must stop doing that. I know Zambia is doing very well now. You are exporting electricity. Good. But what electricity are you generating? I don't think you have more than 3,000 megawatts. So don't sit on your laurels. Because as we are speaking, Iran is generating 70,000 megawatts. Korea is generating nearly 100,000 megawatts. So Zambia does not have electricity to go into full-scale industrialization. So don't celebrate too soon. And Zambia is Africa in microcosm. When you hear our leaders, you go to Kenya, 3,000 megawatts. 3,000 megawatts? That is half what they use to run the airport at Schiphol. I'm being hyperbolic here. So we are saying that you should be entrepreneurs who think big. It is thinking big that is going to change us. If you don't think big, then Africa is not going to grow. You know, I told you about my experience with this audience on healthcare about entrepreneurship. They were talking about the role of private sector in the medical field. So I told them, perhaps some of them knew, that do you know that during COVID-19, Sub-Saharan Africa discovered that the Federal Republic of Germany had more ICU beds than the entire African countries combined. We are 1.4 billion, Germany has a population of 80 million, they had more ICU beds. And I proceeded to say that in quite a number of countries, the things we call ICU are merely ICU because on the door it is written ICU. But otherwise, if you go inside, there are no facilities that suggest that it's an ICU. Could very well be hotel rooms. It is your generation that is going to change that through invention, through creativity, and through boldness. Egerton, or rather Eden University at which we are here, is giving us the opportunity to create such young men and women. But does the environment, the ecosystem that Mabel talked about, what is this ecosystem? Is it an ecosystem that is going to allow the Zambian, the African entrepreneur to thrive? Because Europe and America and increasingly Asia are creating an environment that is toxic to our own invention. You've got to create your own ecosystem. If you don't create it, then you're not right. Many of us here drive cars. And if I were to ask, how many of us here drive new cars? Forget about this second-hand car that you call new because you have newly bought them. Those are not new. They have been discarded by somebody in Japan or somebody in Dubai or in Europe or America. So if you are going to be an entrepreneur in the auto industry, are you going to be an entrepreneur who is importing second-hand clothing? For second-hand cars, will you be an entrepreneur in the textile industry by buying underwear and other garments that have been discarded in Europe, which you make new by taking to the laundry? Real bad happening across the continent of Africa. You see, a very decent African man at a flea market somewhere in in Livingstone or Lusaka or Nairobi, holding an underwear that was recently been worn in Europe and America. Is that the entrepreneurship that we are talking about? Ladies and gentlemen, I will not belabor the issue. We all know what we are talking about. There must be a paradigm shift. We must now begin to ask ourselves, what are we teaching at our universities? What models are we using at our universities? When we talk about incubation, what are we incubating at our universities and in our industries? Can we sustain ourselves if we are shut off? If today, the European and Asian companies that are making spare parts were to stop supplying us with spare parts, would we survive? The beauty is that in our own lifetime we have seen other civilizations go into the arena of entrepreneurship and they have succeeded. In my own lifetime, I've seen the Chinese rise from near nothingness to a state where there is not a single African city today, where there is not an edifice built by the Chinese, including this one. And you find similar products in Nairobi, in Dar es Salaam, in Ghana, in Nigeria. If they did it in 30 years, why can we not do it? In my own lifetime, I've seen the Koreans do it. It can be done. We have seen the Turks do it. It can be done. We have seen the Arabs do it. The solution is here. So today, if there is anything that you come out with, out of this engagement, is only one thing. That I'm thinking without reference to anybody. And number two, I said one, I'm now saying two, that there are no barriers. The wilder the dream, the greater the possibilities. I want you to go and dream. But wake up to live that dream. Because most of us are satisfied in dreaming, wishing that the night never ended. I'm suggesting to us that our night of dreaming must now end. We must now rise up in the morning and begin to live what is. It can be done. Mr. Kanyama said it can be done. Mr. Moira said it can be done. Mabel has said it can't be done. Calvin has said it can't be done. Dr. Pippin has said it can't be done. Why are you saying it cannot be done? We must do it. And you know, as I conclude, it is this generation, at least 80% of you, who will make it happen. We have run our race, some of us. We are handing over the baton. This is a relay race. Don't blame us for the leg we did not run well. Improve on our mistakes and conclude the race. You must do it. Thank you very much.
We can do much better than that. Another round of applause. Allow me to welcome to the stage
that's a different location to say, like, I've been going to get a service there.
It requires a struggle. And you would find that, for instance, the West African countries, whether Nigeria, others, a lot of the sculptures and so on are in European museums. Look at the British Museum. The British Museum would have a lot and lots of stuff which the British colonialism collected from all over, including Africa. When you then engage them in a discussion to say these matters must come back.
Well, I was spoken this for many times.
Because in some instances,
spoken about
that if you brought back these artifacts, which are in exhibition in particular museums and so on in Europe, it could actually mean the museum must cease to exist. The very, very interesting statement that was made by Picasso, the painter. Picasso said that there is an ethnic museum in Paris. There was, I think it's still there. And he got interested in it because it had a lot of these African masks and things like that. Not very well kept, this museum, in terms of cleanliness and all that. So he says it would get quite cold in winter. But he was so fascinated by this, and he would come and watch this, examine this, sculptures and so on, particularly from West Africa. And he says, that is why, that's what made me the painter that I am. Picasso. So you can see the value of this material taken from here to Europe. When you say, please bring them back, you can understand the resistance. I think it's a matter that we just take it as a matter of struggle. The diamond that it was given to the British royalty by De Beers, they donated, I think it was when the now late Queen Elizabeth II, I think it's when she was here and she was 21 years old. They gave her a birthday present, the mining company, De Beers. They gifted her that diamond, which I understand is part of the British crown or something. People are afraid to ask the British to return it. I say good luck to that. The men are very loud in meetings. They know how to shout and to be seen and to be heard and all of that. And the woman is a bit shy, can't they? But you want them to be outspoken, to be as vigorous as the men. But you've got to take particular measures in order to create the possibility where you build that confidence so that women can intervene as any other. That's why I'm saying that in talking about this gender mainstreaming. It's got to be a conscious effort. Women's leagues. Women's leagues are one of the institutions which should be mobilized for this purpose. So it's the task of the Women's League to make sure that the matter about discrimination against women is addressed. And this is what we need to do with regard to that. Where you have a persistent problem of absence of African women leaders on the continent, It's really essentially because, in a sense, the progressive movement on the continent is weak. The matter about emancipation of women and so on is a very political matter. And where you have a progressive movement that is very weak, it will perpetuate the patriarchy. So it's a challenge that on the continent to say, what do we do about a matter like this to develop a movement that would engage this issue in a systematic manner. I think that's a particular challenge. Political movement on the continent is not strong enough. That's why they're not doing this particular issue. The question that is raised about unitary versus federal states, smaller national groups within, is correct. Because all African countries, are diverse countries, almost all of them. Diverse in terms of language groups, cultural groups, religious groups, even color. And indeed, the correct approach, my view, is that the notion of unity in diversity is correct for almost all our countries, South Africa and there. Let's have unity in diversity. As part of that expression of that here, that's why, for instance, it was decided that let's have so many official languages, is to address that matter about unity in diversity. But again, we come back to this issue about the progressive movement. We have this terrible conflict in Ethiopia, has been going on since November 2020. And so all of us have seen the report yesterday that there's a report that Eritrea has now invaded Tigray. Large forces, combined Eritrean forces and the National Army of Ethiopia. At the base of that conflict, which has claimed lots of lives, in terms of that war that's been going on since the end of 2020, is this matter. You have a diverse Ethiopian population, ethnically, whatever the word that is used, are Oromos, Amharas, Tigrayans, and Somalis, and all that. How this is one Ethiopia. Originally, all of them got together, were put together like this as a result of feudalism, conquering by the emperors and the. But in the end, even when it becomes a democratic country, you inherit that reality. A very high sense of consciousness in terms of identity. Yes, I'm Ethiopian, but I'm also Amhara. And so you'd get an argument which says, for instance, when the Tigrayan People's Liberation Front and others removed an earlier government, Mengistu, introduced a new federal constitution. So Ethiopia became a democratic, federal, ethnic state. And the allegation that is made now in the last 2 years, 3 years, has been that in that federal arrangement, the Tigrayans became the dominant force, though they are relatively small. But they became the dominant force. And that's part of the reason for the war that is going on now. So I'm saying that we have a challenge on the continent, practically to address that matter of unity and diversity. In the context of which, then you can decide what kind of political system do you have. A federal system, and when you say federal, what do you mean by federal? To define that federation, and but at the same time you want to keep the national cohesion that we're an Ethiopian together. Though we will recognize the fact that these identities at a lower level must be recognized and respected. At the same time, the national, common national identity must also be respected. I'm saying it's a challenge to construct societies to be able to deal with those sorts of issues. But it's a common problem. It's across the continent. It's here in South Africa. The other day we're talking about our saying publicly, if you look at the ANC, just look at the membership. Over time, the ANC, the membership of the ANC, they're more or less exclusively black African. The fundamental policies of the ANC would be we're a multiracial, multi-faith, multi-color, multi-whatever. And so the ANC, an organization like the ANC, representing the people of South Africa. That's the people of South Africa. But it doesn't, in its membership. Maybe two white people, I don't know. 10 colored people, 15 Indian, and you know, all of that. I'm saying it is a challenge of unity and diversity. How do you manage it? And again, I'd like to say that we come back to the question about the absence of progressive political organizations. And ANC fails to address this matter in terms of its own membership and wants to call itself progressive. How, in what way progressive? It's a fundamental matter, a critically important matter in this country, given the way the population is composed. So yes, indeed, I think the point that was being made, that it's not always necessarily correct that you just have a unitary state which does not recognize the fact of the diversity. I think the observation was correct. With regard to the migration question into South Africa, I think, colleagues, one of the things that we must recognize here is that as our people in the country engaged in the struggle to liberate ourselves from apartheid, the rest of the continent engaged that struggle, got itself involved, support to the liberation movement, support to students, with lots of students, for instance, after 1976, who left and absorbed into schools across the continent. And the African continent has felt for a long time very, very close to this country, that it had its own responsibility to assist in the liberation of the people of South Africa. In the region here, we take a country like Mozambique, just across our border, which lost thousands and thousands of people killed because it was refusing to walk away from support for the struggle here. The same thing happened in Angola. Across the border in Zimbabwe. You know, 1990, in terms of the constitution that had been negotiated for Zimbabwe, the clause which was no redistribution of the land for 10 years. Then 1990, the end of that period, 1990, then Zimbabwe can then change the constitution to address the land question as it wishes. And the leadership of Zimbabwe decided not to. It's a very conscious decision that it is now possible for us to change this constitution so that we can then grapple with this thing about land distribution in Zimbabwe. The reason the leadership decided not to in 1990. They said, look across the border here. Here are our comrades involved in negotiations with the regime to end this apartheid system. If we start a land reform process in Zimbabwe now, it will frighten those whites. It will make it more complicated for our comrades there to negotiate with them. Let's wait. And they waited. In terms of implementing the land reform program, it was entirely not to complicate our situation here. The population in Zimbabwe were saying we fought, we engaged in struggle for land. So, in order to agree to the transition, we agreed temporarily that, okay, we'll get it fixed like this. But now that constitutional restriction is no longer there. And Zimbabwe leadership said, yes, we know very well, we're part of that struggle, but it's important that our South African colleagues down there, they should succeed. So I'm saying, colleagues, people, maybe many of us here would not understand this. The sense of engagement of ordinary Africans with this struggle here. Even the Nigerian government says, doesn't have enough money. But people, you, the public, please contribute. And people contributed money, so they set up a big fund to finance this liberation struggle. South Africa must be free, therefore let's do whatever we can to contribute to that. So over the years, there's a very close attachment that the rest of the continent has had with South Africa. And one of the reasons for that close attachment was that, you know, given the levels of development of South Africa, the struggle in which we're engaged will get rid of this white domination. And then you have a truly liberated South Africa, which will become part of the Organization of African Unity. And it's only then, that we'll be able really to launch our offensive to ensure the development of the continent. Because it brings these resources because of its level of development. I mean, that thing is in the knowledge of Africans throughout all this period. So it's very, very natural when South Africa is free for these Africans to say, let me go and have a look. You can't stop it. You can't say, disengage from your concept about South Africa and forget about your history of connection in terms of the struggle. You are not wanted. I'm saying the practical reality is that, and indeed this country has been more developed than others, it will attract people. There will be migration. We, the ANC, has been a pan-Africanist organization from its birth. So the questions that are raised, for instance, about SADC, integration within the SADC region, this has been part of the concept of the African National Congress forever. Integration on the African continent. That's why I'm saying that we've supported very much our government correctly, this continental free trade area. Now we've got to communicate our messages correctly. I agree with the point that was made. Countries in this region, South Africa, Namibia, Botswana, Lesotho, and so on, the point that was made. Not that they should exist as independent countries, but this matter about integration, the possibility to develop the economies together. At one point, we in government decided that there must be some way by which we help the, when the tourists come to South Africa, help to get them to go over the Drakensberg Mountain into Lesotho. So we could try and build roads and then do whatever, because this idea of integration among ourselves, it's a strong idea, we have to act on it. But I'm saying, there is the obvious thing that will happen, it continue to happen, of other Africans coming to this country. Now, I don't believe that we can have, now I'm talking from point of view of the ANC, you can't have an immigration policy which is just defined by chase away these foreign nationals. You can't. It needs proper management, there is legislation, it needs an agreement across the continent. If the South Africans feel that there are too many Nigerians coming, then let's engage the Nigerian government to say, let's manage this thing together. Because if we communicate one message to the rest of the continent, that the major objective of South African immigration policy is to chase away foreign nationals, we can't have a policy like that. You know, even today, before the Continental Free Trade Area, all these big supermarkets, ShopRite, Checkers, or whatever the others are, they are all over the continent. So we want the rest of the continent to say, okay, your main task is to chase away people you call foreign nationals. We're going to chase you away too. As the ANC, you can't lead a process like that. It's not right. You know, 2010, 2011, 2012, thereabouts, there was quite a lot of this so-called xenophobic attacks in the Western Cape against Somalis. Because these South Africans are xenophobic, away with the Somalis. Well, nothing like that. It had to do with the relations among traders. As a result of which, for instance, there was an agreement signed with traders from Kuguletu, this local South African, and the Somali traders. And the agreement says things like, with regard to these main products, like bread, like mealie-meal, we must all of us charge the same price. There must not be price competition among ourselves. In this area, there should be no more, of if we have 100 spaza shops, no more than 30 should be owned by the Somalis. It was a negotiated agreement signed by the traders, and that is the end of the violence against the Somalis. I keep insisting to this day, and people say that I'm crazy or denialist or something. that the black population of South Africa is not xenophobic. You don't get ordinary people in Alexander Township who wake up in the morning and decide, we don't like the Zimbabweans, let's get them. It doesn't happen. Or Nigerians or something. Somebody else organizes that. Somebody organizes it and says that, like the Cape Town, Western Cape instance I'm talking about. When these traders launch everybody, we hate the Somalis, let them go home. They are taking our jobs and so on. It's traders who are being outcompeted by the Somali traders. And when the matter is addressed and resolved, suddenly, for years and years, we've never had any xenophobic attacks against the Somalis in the Western Cape. So I'm saying, colleague, the colleague who raised the matter about migration, I think we as South Africans need to sort our thinking about this thing correctly. We see ourselves, certainly from the ANC side, as an important engine for the transformation of the continent for the better. And indeed, the rest of the continent, when it engaged us in the struggle against apartheid, the hope was exactly that a liberated South Africa would be in the front ranks in terms of the transformation of the continent for the better. You can't play that role and be respected by the whole continent that the class of South Africa is doing something good for the continent when you define yourself as somebody whose main task is to chase away foreign nationals. It's contradictory. It's a challenge you've got to deal with, because people will come. If the government here had decided to do what President Trump tried in the United States, to build a wall and electrify fences in order to keep a fortress South Africa, it wouldn't work. People would still come. And I would never want to see a South Africa which encircles itself with electrical fences. There was a leader, one of the leaders in Lesotho, a political leader. He says to me one day that his mother says to him, can you please give me 40 rand? So I give my mother 40 rand. And she says to me, no, I need it because I'm going to Bloemfontein. There in Maseru. What are you doing in Bloemfontein? No, I'm going for a medical checkup. No, but if you're going for a medical checkup, they're going to charge you more than 40 rand. And she says, no, I don't need it for the hospital. It's this boy's at the border gate.